Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the November 28th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is set on the mall in front of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. We have Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're on either end of a Make America Great Again banner. They're doing kind of a tug of war and seem to be yelling at each other, and it's starting to rip at the top. The headline is A MAGA Schism. Have Greene and the Epstein files weakened Trump? And we'll pick up part of that on the controversy of the week. We're going to start with the second main story. Saudi prince gets royal welcome at White House. What happened? President Trump welcomed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the White House in grandiose style this week, treating him to a military flyover and a black tie dinner while shrugging off concerns about his role in the gruesome 2018 murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. When a reporter asked about the killing, which U.S. intelligence says was ordered by MBS personally, Trump called her insubordinate and defended his ally. "A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about," Trump said. "Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen." Trump said MBS, the de facto ruler of the Saudi kingdom, knew nothing about it and told the prince, "It's an honor to be your friend, and it's an honor that you are here." To mark the deepening ties, Trump designated Saudi Arabia as a major non-NATO ally and pledged to deliver it top-of-the-line F-35 fighter jets. The two nations also agreed to a defense cooperation pact, a preliminary deal involving civil nuclear power, and an AI deal that grants the Saudis access to U.S. technology. MBS said Saudi Arabia would up its $600 billion U.S. investment commitment to nearly $1 trillion. Trump's family businesses have secured at least nine Saudi deals since 2021, including one this week for a new resort project in the Maldives. But the president said there was no conflict of interest, saying he did very little Saudi business. What the editorial said: the feting of MBS dishonors Khashoggi, said the Washington Post. The brave Saudi journalist had been living in exile in the U.S. because of his writings about the Saudi regime's repressiveness at home and recklessness abroad. MBS may deny involvement in his death, but the CIA amassed convincing evidence that the Crown Prince had Khashoggi lured to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, where members of MBS's personal security detail killed him and used a bone saw to chop up the body so it could be smuggled off the premises. Dismissing such brutality is a choice, and Trump made the wrong one. Still, more influence over Saudi Arabia would be good news, said the Wall Street Journal. It's in the U.S.'s interest to steer Riyadh away from China and toward a long-term Middle East peace agreement. But Trump is offering MBS quite a bit, from F-35s to a potential security guarantee, and so far, he's mainly getting nothing in return but promises of investment. Trump ought to make sure he isn't asking too little. What the columnist said: there are lingering doubts over whether the deals touted this week will even materialize, said Holly Elliott in CNBC.com. The proposed sale of F-35s has angered Israel, the only Middle Eastern country that has such jets. Yet the White House has provided no details on the plan, neither the number of planes nor a time frame for delivery. And MBS's $1 trillion investment pledge is implausible. It's equal to Saudi Arabia's annual economic output. If these deals are finalized, it will be because of MBS's evolution, said Michael Ratney, a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, in the New York Times. When the prince last visited the White House in 2018, he was known for his authoritarianism, having allegedly held and tortured Saudi royal family members and business elites at the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton the year before. While the human rights picture today is still far from perfect, with frequent executions and no real free speech, MBS has made progress, defanging the religious police and eliminating most of the laws that once oppressed the lives of Saudi women. He has also ended his family's tolerance for rampant jihadist fundraising, said Tom Brogan in the Washington Examiner. Saudi intelligence has actually been helping to thwart terrorist plots against Americans. By linking up with MBS, Trump is putting U.S. interests first. No, he's putting his own interests first, as usual, said Parker Malloy in The New Republic. He's flaunting his corruption in plain sight. The Trump Organization is bringing Trump-branded properties to Jeddah, Riyadh, and Diriyah, a historic town set to undergo a $63 billion transformation overseen by MBS. Last year, the developer Dar Global, whose parent company has close ties to the Saudi government, gave the Trump Organization $22 million in licensing fees. As his family profits, Trump sings the prince's praises. His message isn't complicated. If you've got enough money, you can get away with murder. Literally. Controversy of the week, Trump. Is he losing control of MAGA? Marjorie Taylor Greene just wrecked the cult of Trump, said Greg Sargent in The New Republic. Standing outside the U.S. Capitol this week with a group of Jeffrey Epstein victims, the GOP representative slammed the president for calling her a traitor and ranting lunatic because she helped force a vote on releasing government files on the deceased sex trafficker. In a barb clearly aimed at Trump, who reversed his opposition to releasing the files as it became clear he couldn't stop the congressional effort, the Georgia Republican said a traitor serves foreign countries and themselves, while a patriot serves Americans like the women standing behind me now. This rift is a big deal, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. That a notorious Trump slobberer like Green would openly resist the man who coined the phrase, make America great again, is significant. But she's also doing it while promoting the radical idea that MAGA has discrete ideological content beyond the president's whims and daily political needs. If this notion catches fire on the right, Green could find herself leading the first meaningful right-wing rebellion against autocracy of this era. The MAGA crackup goes far beyond Epstein, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. In recent weeks, Green has chided Trump for being too focused on striking foreign deals while ignoring the five-alarm fire of affordability and health care costs. Other MAGA types have been infuriated by the president's un-America First defense of skilled foreign worker visas, which he told Fox News are needed because Americans lack certain talents. A few days later, Trumpist influencer Mike Cernovich was raging online about how overt the corruption is within the administration. It was against this backdrop of spreading disaffection that Trump rebuked Green. Rebukes, she said, led to death threats against her and her family. Many right-wing influencers reacted with unusual fury to Trump's jabs. Some even posted images of burning MAGA hats, a sign that the MAGA coalition is fragmenting. Perhaps, said Joan Bonocchi in the Boston Globe, but if the last decade has taught us anything, it's that Trump's base sticks with him, no matter what. And so far, there's little reason to think that this time will be different. True, Trump's average approval rating, about 40%, is at a second-term low, but it's only down some 2 points from September, which hardly signals some imminent sea change in his political fortunes. Trump's Epstein files U-turn may read as weakness to D.C. insiders, said Jack Blanchard in Politico, but it could be a path to redemption with his base. If Trump fulfills his promises and now delivers an all-out blitz on affordability, slashing tariffs and mailing out $2,000 rebate checks, MAGA might forget its disenchantment. But Trump isn't losing control of MAGA because of the growing incoherence of his politics, said Jeet here in The Nation. Figures like Green are breaking with Trump, and MAGA is splintering because the GOP's voters, donors, and leaders are already looking past Trump to 2028, when the party will need a new standard bearer. Can a political coalition created and unified by a cult leader survive without that cult leader, asked Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. We're about to find out. It's less than a year until the 2026 midterms, and perhaps only months before Donald J. Trump, as a political force, finds himself quacking lamely in the rearview mirror. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for justice. After the estate of O.J. Simpson agreed to pay $58 million to Fred Goldman, whose son, Ron, was murdered along with Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole, in 1994. Although a jury acquitted Simpson of the killings, he was later found liable for the deaths in a civil trial. It was a good week for cooling off periods. After a Chinese man who had his wife cryogenically frozen after her death in 2017 was revealed to have been quietly dating someone else, a living woman, since 2020. Following a public outcry, Gui Junmin, 57, insisted his current relationship is merely a utilitarian arrangement. It was a good week for news hounds after a dog shot a man in Pennsylvania. The 53-year-old victim told police that he put his shotgun down on his bed after cleaning it, whereupon his dog jumped onto the bed, causing the weapon to discharge, hitting the man in his lower back. According to the New York Post, growl play is not suspected. It was a bad week for answers. After Bloomberg's Catherine Lucy, traveling aboard Air Force One, asked President Trump to explain his seeming ambivalence about releasing the government's files on Jeffrey Epstein. Quiet, Trump responded. Quiet, piggy. The White House has since accused Lucy of inappropriate and unprofessional behavior. It was a bad week for change after the U.S. Mint produced its last 1 cent coin. The distinctive copper-colored pennies will remain in circulation, but were deemed prohibitively expensive to manufacture at an approximate cost of 4 cents per unit. Finally, it was a bad week for alternative medicine after the American Academy of Pediatrics shot down claims circulating on TikTok that children can be cured of colds or the flu by placing slices of raw potato or onion in their socks. This does not happen, said spokeswoman Dr. Joanna Parga-Belenke. And in other news, FEMA chief resigns after series of failures. The embattled acting head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency announced his resignation this week, adding to the chaos inside the troubled agency. David Richardson's six-month tenure was marked by repeated criticism of his leadership. A former Marine combat veteran, painter, and martial arts instructor who lacked any experience in disaster response. He made headlines in June after telling his staff he didn't know the U.S. had a hurricane season. The agency later said he was joking. And when flash floods devastated Texas Hill Country in July, killing at least 135 people, including young girls at a Christian camp, Richardson was uncontactable for 24 hours. Morale at the agency has sunk amid budget cuts, layoffs, and public attacks from administration figures, including Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and President Trump, who has called for FEMA to be shuttered. The briefing this week is titled American Antisemitism. The world's oldest hatred is on the rise in the U.S. Why? What do the numbers show? That antisemitism is surging. According to FBI data, there were 2,086 anti-Jewish hate crime incidents in 2024, up 4% from 2023. And the highest number since records began in 1991. While Jews make up only about 2% of the population, 17% of all reported hate crimes last year were against Jews. But the FBI data doesn't capture the full scale of the spike in anti-Semitism because it includes only crimes reported to authorities. The Anti-Defamation League recorded more than 9,000 incidents of harassment, vandalism, and assault in 2024, the highest number since it began tracking data in 1979. And a report published by the organization last month found that 57% of Jewish Americans believe anti-Semitism is now a normal part of Jewish life in the U.S. For decades, most anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. stemmed from old conspiracies and tropes, such as a 2019 attack on a California synagogue by a gunman who believed Jews controlled the news media. But since October 7, 2023, when Hamas attacked Israel and sparked the Gaza War, a larger share of perpetrators has cited Israel or Zionism. For anti-Semites, said Oren Segal of the ADL, the Israel issue has been a convenient tactic to pile onto the Jewish community. Did anti-Semitism increase significantly after October 7th? In the 3 months after Hamas attack, anti-Semitic incidents were up 361% compared with the same period a year earlier, according to the ADL. The organization counted 3,291 incidents in that period, including bomb threats against synagogues, swastikas spray painted onto Jewish schools, and 56 physical assaults. The violence seemed to intensify this year. In April, a man set fire to Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's residence as Shapiro, who is Jewish, and his family slept inside. The attacker said he was motivated by Shapiro's support of Israel. The next month, two young Israeli embassy aides were shot dead as they left an event at the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. The alleged gunman told police, "I did it for Palestine." 11 days later, in Boulder, Colorado, a man shouting "Free Palestine" threw Molotov cocktails at demonstrators calling for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza. An 82-year-old woman later died of her wounds. People like me made arguments for years about how you should be able to criticize Israel and not be seen as anti-Semitic, said Joel Rubin, a deputy assistant secretary of state under President Barack Obama. That's collapsed, and attacks on Zionism now target Jews. What's behind the spike in attacks? Some experts argue that anti-Semitism on the left is being driven by ideas that about settler colonialism, an academic theory that divides the world into foreign colonizers and indigenous peoples, oppressors and the oppressed. Under this theory, Jews are not a historically oppressed people with historical ties to Israel, said Harvard Law School professor Noah Feldman, but instead are imperialist and even white supremacists who have stolen Palestinian land. Under such an ideology, violence against any oppressor can be justified. Some researchers argue that criticism of Israel is too often conflated with anti-Semitism by the ADL and others. And note that anti-Semitism was rising in the U.S. before 2023. To lump as anti-Semitic all people who don't believe in Zionism is just wrong, said Kevin Racklin of the Nexus Project, a nonprofit that combats anti-Semitism. Still, he adds that anti-Semitism has unequivocally increased in the U.S. since 2023, and that bigotry is gaining traction on the right as well as the left. What's happening on the right? A growing number of America First figures are embracing old anti-Semitic tropes. Nick Fuentes, a 27-year-old white supremacist influencer, has blamed organized Jewry for sowing division in the U.S. and claimed American Jews put Israel's interest before the interest of their home country. Conservative writer Ron Dreher said he was told by a Washington insider that 30-40% of young GOP staffers in D.C. are Fuentes fans. Candace Owens, one of the nation's most popular podcasters, claims the U.S. has a Zionist-occupied government and has dismissed accounts of the torturous experiments conducted by Nazi scientists on Jewish and other prisoners during World War II as bizarre propaganda. Tucker Carlson, the top right-wing podcaster in the U.S., has hosted Fuentes on his show, as well as Nazi apologist blogger and Holocaust denier Daryl Cooper, whom Carlson called the most important popular historian working in the United States today. Are many Americans receptive to these messages? Conservative commentator Ben Shapiro, who formerly employed Owens at his Daily Wire site and is a frequent target of anti-Semites online, said there's a ready audience for anti-Jewish conspiracies among young people who feel the economy is against them. They are told their troubles can be solved by externalizing those problems onto different groups, said Shapiro, who adds that social media algorithms incentivize such conspiratorialism. You get a lot more likes and clicks if you're promoting an anti-Israel, anti-Jewish agenda than if you're doing the opposite. Research shows that anti-Semitism is blooming on the major social media platforms, most of which have dialed back content moderation in recent months. An Israeli study found a 41% increase in anti-Semitic posts on TikTok from 2020 to 2021, a 912% increase in anti-Semitic comments, and a 1,375% increase in anti-Semitic usernames. Another study by the Center for Countering Digital Hate and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs identified nearly 679,600 anti-Semitic posts on Elon Musk's X platform over 11 months that garnered a combined 193 million views, despite being in violation of X's own anti-Semitism policies. Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and hate that were once fringe have been wholly normalized, said Amy Spitalnik, head of the JCPA, and they're thriving in plain sight. Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with the Pope's moral rebuke of Trumpism. A Christian answer to the cruelty and corruption of Trumpism has finally arrived, said David French. The American-born Pope Leo XIV and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops are denouncing President Trump's cruel roundups of immigrants, in stark contrast to the overwhelming support he's received from my fellow evangelical Christians. In a statement approved 216-5, the bishops rebuke those who are creating a climate of fear and anxiety among immigrants through dehumanizing rhetoric and violence and indiscriminate mass deportation. Leo has taken the lead on this issue, reminding Christians that Jesus clearly states in Scripture that people will be judged on how they treat the foreigner. Leo has questioned whether those who oppose abortion but approve of the inhuman treatment of immigrants are actually pro-life. The Pope's stance is not partisan. It is a moral position, what Martin Luther King Jr. called serving as the conscience of the state. In the great moral struggle of our times, the Catholic Church's reminder that every human being should be treated with dignity and respect should matter. Unless the values behind Trumpism are defeated, our culture will continue to slide into cruelty and depravity. Valid fears about orders to kill. Do military leaders fear they could one day be prosecuted for following President Trump's orders to carry out deadly airstrikes in the Caribbean? Asked Greg Sargent. One telling sign is that the admiral in command of the U.S. operations in the region, Alvin Holsey, abruptly stepped down last month without public explanation. Evidently, Holsey did not want to follow Trump's orders to blow up boats of alleged drug smugglers without congressional approval. To allay such concerns, the New York Times reports, the Justice Department has issued a secret memo classifying these assassinations, which have killed 80 people so far, as acts of war against foreign terrorist organizations. Most legal experts doubt the legitimacy of classifying drug smugglers as terrorists. Nevertheless, the memo states that everyone in the chain of command who carries out the killings has battlefield immunity. The need to offer an affirmative legal shield against future prosecution may not be as reassuring as the administration intended. Are you really sure you want to trust Donald Trump, of all people, when he tells you that what he's directing you to do is lawful and that you'll be protected later as a result? This is an international How They See Us column. Mamdani's victory has global reach. There are few contemporary parallels to the worldwide excitement over Zoran Mamdani's election in New York City, said Vivek Menezes in O Heraldo in India. New York has always been seen as a beacon to the world, a place anyone might visit or even immigrate to. Watching New Yorkers elect their first Muslim mayor was history in the making, like Barack Obama's initial ascent to the White House, or the electrifying 1989 moment when the Berlin Wall was breached. Mamdani, 34, showed the easy mastery of social media common to his generation, but it was his message that captivated everyone from his native Uganda to his ancestral India and beyond. He ran on the opposite of the divisive politics of exclusion that has dominated our time. Positively Gandhian, he preached, hope instead of fear, bringing people together instead of pitting them against each other. Mamdani's victory is a signal to Gen Z protesters across the planet that there might be ways out of our highly exhausting age of oligarchs and militaristic might makes right. The scare tactic of Islamophobia is losing its power, said Talal Al-Kal. Mamdani refused to be treated like a boogeyman as he stood up proudly for the Palestinian cause. Israel's genocidal war in Gaza has clearly undermined Trump's popularity and that of Republicans in general. Mamdani was part of a historic wave of Muslim success, as a record 42 Muslims were elected across the U.S. in the recent off-year elections. The only wave Mamdani is riding is the anti-Semitic tsunami, fed by his outspoken rejection of Zionism, said Zvika Klein in the Jerusalem Post. New York has long been a symbol of Jewish success in America. But now, for the first time, it will be run by a politician with a history of hostility toward the Jewish state. Since Hamas' horrific terrorist attack ignited the Gaza War in 2023, anti-Semitism has spread across the U.S., and Jewish students now feel unsafe on campuses where classmates chant, "From the river to the sea." Jews now have to wonder, is there anywhere outside of Israel that is truly secure for us? Mamdani scares a lot of people, said Celia Walden in The Telegraph. London real estate agents have been fielding panic calls from wealthy New Yorkers looking to escape their new socialist mayor and his millionaire's tax. But the grass will almost certainly not be any greener in Mayor Sadiq Khan's London. While we may not have the homicide rate of New York, we did have 16,344 knife attacks last year. Nothing works properly here, and customer service in general just isn't a thing. Look, Mamdani may not create a socialist utopia, said Witold Jaraz in the Onet, but he speaks to an issue that resonates with young residents of large cities beyond New York, acknowledging that the replacement of capitalism with turbo-capitalism has been followed by the pauperization of broad sections of society. Unlike their parents, this generation will likely live poorer than previous ones. They want to replace ossified elites with authentic leaders who will fight the forces of entrenched wealth on behalf of the rest of us. After all, freedom without bread isn't really freedom. The last word, our feature article, titled The Disappeared. Stories of a few deportees have caught the public eye, said Caitlin Dickerson in The Atlantic. But hundreds of thousands more, some with U.S. citizen children, have been quietly expelled. One morning in March, as ICE was building momentum in carrying out President Donald Trump's mass deportation campaign, dozens of people who had recently been detained throughout Virginia were being rushed through preliminary hearings. The government was using Zoom to save time, so Judge Karen Donoso Stevens sat in a mostly empty courtroom, adjourning some proceedings in less than 2 minutes each. Donoso Stevens yelled at a man to stop talking while his own case was being heard and became frustrated when another who got confused when she referred to him as the man in the green jacket. He wasn't wearing a green jacket. When a father said he was scared to leave the country without his five-year-old, she ignored the comment and asked if he had enough money to pay for his ticket home. I was in court that day hoping to see how Trump's new deportation mandate was playing out, but the hearings were moving so quickly that I was having trouble keeping up. Some people said they needed more time to find lawyers or fill out applications. I was getting only snippets of people's stories as one bled into the next. But time seemed to slow around noon when Donoso Stevens called a man from El Salvador with pale skin and short curly hair, wearing an orange jumpsuit, with his hands cupped behind his back. "I'm very worried about my three babies," he said in a slow, shaky voice. "The officers arrested me in front of the two littlest ones, who are 2 and 4. He began to cry, explaining that his youngest had been sick and that his four-year-old's first words to him since the arrest had been to ask if the officers who took him away had hurt him. Since then, I've often thought of that man while scrolling social media, where the stories of other people arrested by ICE have gone viral, turning some into minor celebrities. There was Ming Carol Lee Hugh, a waitress and mother from Missouri whose Trump-supporting neighbors and customers wore Bring Carol Home t-shirts, and Marcelo Gomez da Silva, a high school student in Massachusetts whose friends posted signs of his face in their front yards, and Narcisco Barranco, the California landscaper, whose three sons, all Marines, went on national television to decry their father's violent arrest. These stories have spread because they seem, due to the young age of the person arrested, their contributions to the country, or the fact that they have young children at home, like exceptions whose treatments were uniquely harsh. Sitting in immigration court, I saw firsthand that they represent the norm. There was at least one deportation case that most Americans would likely support, a man who had been convicted of child sodomy. But most detainees were people without a criminal history who were worried about getting back to their families and their jobs. I wondered if the crying father might have also become a household name if his story were online. Instead, like most people who are detained across the country right now, he remained unknown and unreachable. Most of Trump's deportation campaign is inaccessible because after arrests are made, it is moving quickly, far from public view. In the age of virality, our devices offer up individual case studies, allowing us to congregate around them virtually. Although this is useful in helping us understand what happens when a person is plucked from their home, it takes our attention away from the larger story. More than 500,000 people deported, millions more at risk, and focuses us instead on a tiny part of it. More than 70% of people in immigration custody have no criminal past, although ICE has not released data on how many of them left children behind when they were arrested. The fact that an estimated 6 million kids in the United States have at least one parent without legal status suggests that this is the case for many. And detention centers for children have been packed since Trump took office. But none of this is easy to witness. The high-profile incidents have also helped a select few who are slated for deportation raise money for lawyers or even be released. But they risk creating the impression that sharing stories on social media might somehow keep ICE's work at bay. It won't. Congress recently tripled the agency's budget, making it the highest-funded law enforcement agency in the country, and allocated $45 billion to expand its detention centers. When Marcelo Gomez da Silva, the Massachusetts high school student, was released, he held a press conference, surrounded by supporters. He seemed most troubled not by his own arrest, which took place while he was driving himself and some friends to volleyball practice, but by the prevalence of experiences like his. He said that he had told the other men he was detained with, "When I'm out, if I'm the only one who is able to leave that place, I lost," adding, "I want to do whatever I can to get them as much help as possible." Amid the barrage of stories flooding our phones, Gomez da Silva was conveying something that's easy to miss. For every person arrested whose name and story we've learned, there are thousands we haven't heard about. Despite becoming famous for being treated harshly, Gomez da Silva is one of the lucky ones. Most people detained by ICE are being housed in sprawling complexes in rural areas where the land is cheap and the protests are few. Akeev Dawson, a criminologist at Georgia Southern University, has been conducting research at the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, which can hold up to 2,000 people at a time. She told me a lawful permanent resident of 50 years, whose child is a U.S. citizen and whose deceased wife was as well. The man explained in court that ICE agents had mistaken him for someone else when they arrested him, but he admitted in court to having a single criminal conviction, simple marijuana possession from 30 years ago. So the judge decided to let the deportation case against him proceed. The man told the judge that his belongings would soon be thrown into the street if he wasn't released. He needed to go back to work and pay rent. He began to panic, Dawson told me. He said, "My people don't even know that I'm here. They came and took me from my bed." Dawson said the man asked the judge why this was happening after he had spent so many decades in the United States. She replied, "Sir, this is happening across the country." Dawson also told me about a young mother from Ecuador who had followed the legal process for requesting asylum and pleaded to be released on bail so that she could be reunited with her 2-year-old son, whom she had left with a neighbor. She begged, Dawson said, and recalled the woman saying, "Please, give me an opportunity so that I can do the process the right way." The woman said she wouldn't be able to continue with her asylum case if she was going to have to do it from inside a detention center. "I have a child. I can't be here too long without him," she said. With that, the judge said the woman had waived her right to relief and continued processing her for removal from the country. "Are you going to deport me with my son?" the woman asked. "I don't have anyone to keep him here." "You would need to talk to your deportation officer," the judge replied. According to Dawson, "I'm only handling your case." Dawson pointed out that neither of these people, like the significant majority of those who are being held in ICE custody, had an attorney to defend them, making them 5.5 times more likely to lose their case and be deported. Unlike criminal defendants, immigrants who cannot afford an attorney are not legally entitled to a public defender, and even those who can afford to hire representation are hard-pressed to find it in the remote areas where they are being detained. There is one immigration lawyer based in Lumpkin full-time. For more than a decade after the facility opened, there was none. Some lawyers represent clients there virtually, but presenting a compelling case via a computer screen can be difficult, especially with temperamental technology and glitchy internet connections. More than 9 in 10 people detained there lose their immigration case and are deported. ICE is supposed to track when it arrests people who have minor children and to ensure that their wishes for where their children end up are carried out in the case of deportation. But immigrant advocates say they worry, given how quickly new officers are being trained, that the agency may not be keeping adequate records, as was the case with families who were separated at the southwestern border the first time Trump was president. In the absence of clarity, it's become common to underestimate the scale of what is happening. In August, for example, a public outcry followed the arrest in a New York City courthouse of a 6-year-old who was initially reported to be the first child detained in the city during Trump's second term. Soon after, however, journalists found that in the 2 months prior to that incident, 48 children had been arrested in the jurisdiction that includes the city. Data obtained through the Freedom of Information Act showed that 32 of those children had already been deported. Their stories were simply missed. Chance has long played an outsized role in immigration courts. There are no juries, and a person's likelihood of winning can depend more on the judge they are assigned than the facts of their case. Social media has only exacerbated this phenomenon. Marcelo Gomez da Silva's lawyer, Robin Nice, told me that as the community rallied around her client, the chief ICE prosecutor called her directly to discuss the situation, a first in her 13-year career. And his bond hearing was scheduled faster than she had seen in any previous case. And Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, personally inquired about a mother and 3 children from Sackett's Harbor, New York, whose detention had prompted a public publicity campaign led by local teachers. Homan grew up nearby and said the case was unfortunate because it brought undue attention to the town where he would like to retire. The family was quickly released. Months after I sat in the Virginia Immigration Court, I managed to track down the father whose story had stayed with me. His experience was full of the kinds of details that have led most Americans to believe that Trump has taken his deportation mandate too far. But he asked not to be named in my story for fear that drawing attention to his family could further harm them. The man's lawyer, Vishru Shilat, explained that his client has lived in the United States since 2018 and has no criminal record. The man landed in ICE custody after being arrested in January when a neighbor called the police and accused him of breaking into a car and of having a domestic dispute. Both charges were dropped when he and his wife denied having a fight and proved that the car he was trying to get into was their own. Despite this, he wasn't eligible for bail because he was arrested days after Congress passed the Laken Riley Act. The law is named after a young woman who was raped and murdered by a man who was previously released from criminal custody on bail. It makes people who have been accused but not convicted of relatively minor infractions such as theft ineligible for pretrial release. Judge Donoso Stevens had explained that under the new law, her hands were tied. Even after the police acknowledged that he hadn't attempted to steal anything, the accusation alone meant that he would have to spend months in jail. Shilat told me that his client's landlord had already begun eviction proceedings against his client's wife, who could no longer pay the rent. She and their three children had been buying food with donations from relatives and their church, but they are not sure how long those will last. Without any hope of release, the man agreed to be returned to El Salvador, leaving his wife and children behind. He hopes to file a petition when he arrives to return to his family as soon as possible. His application will land in a pile of many from people whose stories we'll never hear. A version of this story was originally published in The Atlantic. And we'll catch a couple of the Talking Points articles. Patel, why the FBI is adrift. It's hard to keep track of the FBI director's many embarrassments, said Steve Bannon in MSNOW.com. Cash Patel has made more than a dozen personal trips on his $5,000 an hour government jet, including several visits to see his girlfriend, country musician Alexis Wilkins, in Nashville. During the shutdown, he made taxpayer-funded trips to a Texas hunting operation called the Boondoggle Ranch and a wrestling event in State College, Pennsylvania, to hear Wilkins sing the national anthem. Meanwhile, he's conducted a brazenly political personnel purge of dozens of career FBI agents involved in any past investigation of Donald Trump or January 6th, or in one case, for displaying a gay pride flag on his desk. When activist Charlie Kirk was assassinated, said Sadie Gurman in the Wall Street Journal, Patel announced on social media within hours that a subject was in custody, but it was a false alarm, and the real suspect was arrested the next day. In Patel's own words, his nine-month tenure has been effing wild. Even some right-wing media pundits are getting fed up with Patel's antics, said Will Sommer in The Bulwark. Some are baselessly alleging that Wilkins is a honeypot working for Israel's Mossad intelligence agency. Wilkins, now surrounded by a 24-hour FBI security detail, hasn't taken it quietly, suing at least three commentators for defamation. Many MAGA supporters see Patel as a failure, said Mark Fisher in The New Yorker. On social media, they're castigating him for withholding the Epstein files and for failing to indict Democratic elites for the Russiagate hoax, the COVID lab leak, and other of their favorite conspiracies. Patel's most serious failures are quite real, said Garrett Graff and Mother Jones. He has reassigned more than 3,000 FBI agents from duties such as counterterrorism to aiding deportation efforts, a shocking abdication of our nation's security. He has used polygraph tests to enforce political loyalty within the agency and has alienated scores of career agents. He angered Britain's M15 by breaking a promise to keep an FBI liaison in London who was vital to an intelligence operation regarding China. Now the UK and the Netherlands have suspended some intelligence sharing with the US because they feel they can't trust us. Patel's farcical reign is no joke. We are less safe as a country when the FBI is distracted. Healthcare. Does the GOP have a plan? Republicans won the government shutdown, said Stephen T. Dennis in Bloomberg, but now they must solve a healthcare mess that risks upending the balance of power in Washington. Enhanced subsidies for people who get their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act's exchanges were the centerpiece of the shutdown fight and are now set to expire at the end of the year. That means some 24 million Americans would see their health care premium cost jump 114% on average. If Republicans do kill the higher subsidies, which the Biden administration provided during COVID in 2021, they would save billions of dollars, but it would carry a heavy political cost ahead of next year's midterms. Democrats want to extend the subsidies and are hammering home their message that Trump failed to deliver on his promise to lower the cost of living. Health insurance premiums that double or even triple will only feed Trump's affordability problem. That's why Republicans are fishing for an alternative, said Megan R. Wilson in the Washington Post. This one, the one many conservative lawmakers seem to prefer, is to redistribute some of ACA subsidies into pre-funded health savings accounts, HSAs, or flexible spending accounts, which could help people to pay for care out of pocket. But money in those accounts is for medical expenses only and can't be used for monthly insurance premiums. Healthy people may then choose to drop out of the insurance market entirely, leaving insurers with a pool of sick people who have chronic pre-existing conditions. Health economists warn that this could trigger a death spiral in which people who keep their insurance coverage face soaring premiums. It's all part of the Republicans' long-standing plan to destroy the ACA, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. Their absurd plans would leave Americans either without insurance or at the mercy of unregulated insurance companies. The reality is that Republicans will never find a health care replacement, said Ryan Cooper in the American Prospect. The GOP is wedded to free markets and scornful of the welfare state, but health care and health insurance are far too expensive for people to pay for them out of pocket. Regulations and subsidized insurance are necessary to ensure that sick people can afford treatments and surgeries that can cost two or three times their annual incomes. And the ACA remains the most palatable option we've got. And a few of the short notes. The Department of Homeland Security has diverted many of its 7,000 investigative agents from their normal duties, such as investigating sex crimes against children and networks that finance terrorism, to focus on arresting undocumented immigrants. As a result of the shift, investigators worked approximately 33% fewer hours on child exploitation cases from February through April compared with the average in prior years. President Trump lowered tariffs on Swiss imports from 39% to 15% last week after a delegation of Swiss executives presented him with a Rolex desk clock and a personalized 1 kilogram gold bar. Trump accepted the gifts on behalf of his presidential library. U.S. universities saw a 17% decline in new enrollment by foreign students this fall, the sharpest drop since records began in 1948, with the exception of the COVID pandemic. Of the schools that reported lower numbers, 96% cited issues over students' visa applications. On a list released by the Trump administration of 614 people arrested in Chicago on immigration charges in recent weeks, only 16 had criminal histories, including 5 charged with domestic battery and 2 with drunk driving. None had been charged with rape or murder. The administration says its crackdown is focused on the worst of the worst. On the poll watch, 1 in 5 Americans, say they want to permanently move to another country. 40% of women 15 to 44 want to leave, up from 10% in 2014. 53% of Americans disapprove of how ICE is handling its job, and 39% approve. And we'll finish the show. We'll go back to Benjamin Franklin, quoted in the Chicago Tribune. He says, "Freedom of speech is a principal pillar of a free government. When this support is taken away, the constitution of a free society is dissolved and the tyranny is erected on its ruins." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.